Well, our special UFO extravaganza tonight, James Fox standing by. Leslie Kane is an investigative journalist whose articles have appeared in numerous magazines, newspapers around the world. Just an example here, the Baltimore Sun, the Nation magazine, the Philadelphia Inquirer. Since 2000, Leslie has published investigative stories related to the UFO subject. We're going to talk with her in a moment about her effort to obtain government documents about the crash of the unknown object in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, that occurred 42 years ago. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Tell you a little bit more about Leslie Kane. She's been a plaintiff in a lawsuit against NASA, which she filed in December of 2003, demanding the release of further documentation relating to the Kecksburg incident. It was just settled, as I mentioned, a few weeks ago, requiring NASA to conduct an extensive search for documents under court supervision. They didn't want to do it, but that's the settlement agreement in court. Here she is, Leslie Kane. Hey, Leslie, how are you?
Very good, George. Thanks for having me.
Good job. How did you get this done, this ability to get NASA to start looking for documents?
Well, it's been a long road. I think a lot of the way we got it done was because I had an absolutely incredible attorney who knows a lot about the Freedom of Information Act, and she worked way beyond the call of duty, filed many briefs that she took to court, and went back and forth with NASA on this, and it was really because of her expertise that we had the success that we did. So I'm very fortunate to have had an incredible team of people working with me on this.
How did you get involved in the, you've been an investigative journalist for a good part of your career. How did you get involved in the search and uncovering of UFO stories?
Well, that's the way it happened in the beginning, George, was in 1999. I was working at a public radio station in California just doing my job, and I had done a lot of freelance publishing of stories. And a colleague from France sent me an English translation of the Cometa Report, which you're probably familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And just for people that don't know, very briefly, it's a document, it's a study actually that was done in France by a group of high-level military people into the UFO subject, and they spent 3 years studying it and published this 90-page document. And I was given this advanced copy in English before anybody else had it. And what was amazing about the study was that they concluded that the most likely hypothesis to explain the phenomenon is the extraterrestrial hypothesis.
Yep.
And, you know, it was very stunning to me to see that, because we're dealing here with a bunch of generals and admirals and high-level people. And, you know, as a journalist, I thought this was really an incredible bit of news. And I just got hooked. And ever since then, I mean, I'd read a little bit about UFOs over the years, but that was the story that really got me systematically looking into the subject. And I haven't been able to stop ever since.
It was a riveting story, Leslie, that did not get picked up by, most of the mainstream media.
It's true. I mean, I was stunned, you know, because I thought it was such an incredible piece of news. It went out on the New York Times wire service, and it got picked up, maybe as far as I know, you know, a few papers across the country that kind of shortened it and ran little piece sections.
Blips,
of it.
Yeah.
You're right. I mean, I was just, I'm still kind of baffled as to why more people don't think this is a big deal. But I certainly do.
Well, we've only got you for about 15 minutes. Let's talk about the Kecksburg incident and the information that you were able to release. Why did you go after NASA to get this information?
Well, the whole work with the Kecksburg case started back in 2002 when I was actually invited by Larry Lansman from the Sci-Fi Channel to spearhead an effort involving a UFO case. They wanted to put some resources into really going after a particular UFO case, and we decided on the Kecksburg case for a lot of reasons, one being that it was not that well known. It had a lot of living witnesses that were still around, extremely well documented. There was an investigator that had been working on it for 40 years. And it involved the retrieval of a physical object, which meant there could be some physical evidence, and it was nearby. For all these reasons, we just thought this was a great case. And that's how I got involved with this particular case. And then we began filing all these Freedom of Information Act requests and ended up kind of following the trail on the NASA end of it for a number of reasons. I can go into those if you want, but that was the agency that sort of led us down a path in which we were able to keep going and going and going until we got to the point of filing a lawsuit.
The military claims that it was a meteor that hit, right?
Yeah, which really would mean a meteor that nothing hit. They say that nothing came down because a meteor, by definition, is something that burns up in the sky. So
mm-hmm.
You're right. I mean, it was a direct, blatant, black and white contradiction to what all the witnesses reported, which was another reason the case was so interesting. You have these two opposing realities, and, you know, many, many, many people reported various aspects of the retrieval of this event, and it all added up to paint a very clear picture of what happened, versus the Air Force that said that absolutely nothing was found. And it's just, I cannot believe that to be the case after having spent a lot of time with the case and with the witnesses and with Stan Gordon, who's been investigating it for 40 years. So we just want to know what came down that night.
And what did they haul away that looked like a huge acorn?
Exactly. What did they haul away and where did it go? And all the things that we have a right to know, unless they tell us that due to national security concerns, they can't release the information. Fair enough, but we don't want them to keep telling us that nothing at all happened, because that just isn't true.
Yeah, I think, Leslie, a lot of people would accept something like this. National security, we can't tell you what happened. We'll tell you something crashed in that field. We've retrieved it. We're not going to tell you anything else. You know what? Let us as journalists go after them for that, but at least say something like that.
You're absolutely right, George. We would be very happy with a response like that. Absolutely. And they're required under the law that if they do not want to reveal something, they're required to let us know that they can't reveal it due to national security reasons. So we'd be thrilled with that, because at least they'd be acknowledging that something happened.
Absolutely. You know, was it a plane? Can't tell you. Was it a UFO from space? Can't tell you. Well, that's fine, but at least you've admitted that something here crashed, that these people aren't seeing things.
Exactly. And, you know, these people that live in this rural part of Pennsylvania are being told by their own government that they are either liars or hoaxers. And, you know, it's a terrible thing to live with. They've lived with that ever since. And these are patriotic, good people. And they don't like to be told that by their own government. And so that's a real, real problem for them, and they deserve an answer to this.
Leslie, you're leading down a path where you believe that whatever is happening is truly extraordinary. Have you made any personal decisions in your own life in terms of ascertaining what this might be?
You know, George, I mean, I'd certainly open to as the Cometa Group is, you know, to the possibility I do entertain the extraterrestrial hypothesis as a perfectly logical and legitimate explanation for this phenomenon. And so that's one of, you know, and each case, of course, has its own parameters, and you have to look at every case and try to determine what could have happened. But the body of evidence is so strong, certainly points in that direction. I don't think we have any proof for it. Basically, we're dealing with something that's unknown. But, you know, the evidence is so overwhelming that there is something out there. There's absolutely no question that there's something out there, and there are things out there that demonstrate extraordinary technological ability, and we don't know what they are. So, and that's one reason why we're holding this major event next week, to allow people to present the best possible evidence for this reality.
How long does NASA have now to conduct their search for documents, and what do you think they're going to find?
Well, that's a good question. They have, I don't know exactly. I have to look at the document. It's a number of months, and it's all spelled out by the court that within certain time frames they have to take certain steps. So they have to search this archive by this date. And it's going to take a number of months, and they're allowed to have certain extensions, which if they need them, which I'm happy to, you know, to allow them to have. So I'd say it's going to take maybe 4 or 5 months before we get everything. And what we're hoping to find, of course, is any document that sheds any light at all on the Kexbird situation. I mean, ideally it would be something that tells us what the object actually was, but we'd be very happy with documents that even told us that there was a large military presence that night, that something was taken away, or whatever they might show us, or as you suggested, something that shows that it's a national security concern. So anything that sheds light on this case, we'll be very happy, and we're hoping very much that that's what we end up with.
Was Project Blue Book still going on in 1965 when whatever this may be crashed?
It was, yes. And the documents that we do have, the only documents we have, came from Project Blue Book, from the Air Force, which are the ones that tell us that it was just a meteor and they didn't find anything. So where we got that information from.
Why would NASA have their own separate files on this?
Well, because NASA was very involved at the time with the retrieval of space debris. Whenever anything came down from space, NASA was involved. And so, and we have documents that prove this, that they had all kinds of collections of things called frigology files that dealt with fallen space debris. They had officials that went around and retrieved things. So, and also some witnesses on the scene that night did report seeing NASA personnel there.
Might it have been a fallen Soviet satellite?
Could it have been a satellite?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's a very complicated question. As far as I'm concerned, it could not be, because I spoke to a very, very top level, probably one of the best specialists in the world on orbital debris and space debris. And he did this extensive search for me. His name's Nicholas Johnson, and I have something about him on the website. But he basically ruled out the possibility of it having been any satellite, because he checked all the data and told me that there are records kept of anything that comes into the atmosphere. And if something had come into the atmosphere that was a satellite at that time, he would know about it. So I trust this man's take on the whole thing. He's, as I said, a top expert in the world.
For our benefit, Leslie, tell us a little bit about Kecksburg. What was reported?
Well, what was reported was that at about 5 p.m., something came down. Some people saw it as a fireball. Other people saw it as it got closer, as you mentioned, as sort of an acorn-shaped thing. It landed in the woods. There was some sort of blue smoke for a while. People started calling in the radio stations and the police, and a lot of people started driving to the area because the radios were talking about it. People thought initially it was a plane, but they quickly found out that no planes had crashed. So what happened eventually was that the military came out. They cordoned off the area, quite a large number of them, armed military, and tried to keep people away from the area. And then a few hours later, this thing was seen being hauled out of the woods on the back of a flatbed truck and driven away. And the whole thing took about, I'd say by 1 o'clock in the morning, the thing was gone. And so during all this time, hundreds of people came down to the area because it was all over the news, all over the TV, all over the radio. And we have lots of records that were of media and newspaper stories that were done at the time. So it was a very big event in the area and for people there.
The people in Kecksburg to date, do they still talk about this?
Absolutely, George, they do. And in fact, the little tiny firehouse in Kecksburg, which is a tiny little village, it's really a hamlet, this little firehouse, which is very close to the site, they have a big model of the Kecksburg object right outside the firehouse. So it's very important to people there. Absolutely.
Gosh, how dramatic. And, of course, did we ever in the Kecksburg case hear anything about bodies being retrieved or anything like that?
No, that's a good point. We don't have any stories. There may have been one witness who reported something to Stan Gordon, who's been the investigator on this case. But, the overall picture is no, that it was just this object that had no seams, no windows, no doors. Just looked like it was, a solid thing that you couldn't get in or out of. These are the reports from people who saw it very close up. And they also said there were on the bumper on the bottom, which was sort of like the bottom of the acorn, there were hieroglyphic-type markings on it. It was certainly big enough for a human being to fit inside. They said it was about 15 feet.
That is pretty good size.
Pretty good size, but there was no visible means of propulsion or any way of accessing the inside of the thing. So it's hard to say. It was lying in a gully, so maybe something was on the other side of it. But certainly didn't look to them like anything any of them had ever seen before, and it was extremely bizarre looking to people.
I don't think it was an Apollo capsule, was it?
No, I just don't think so, because I think we would have a record of that. That's the thing. I mean, it
would. We should, yeah. And you just
have records of anything that comes into the atmosphere.
Yeah, and you can publicly say, hey, we launched a few Apollos for testing, and this is what happened.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's really, really a mystery. The whole thing is, the more we learn about it, George, the more mysterious it becomes. Because the more we learn, the more we're able to eliminate all the explanations that one would think it could be. So, and, certainly the people that saw it all thought it was something from another world.
Did we ever find a government whistleblower, somebody who was out there at the scene?
That we have not found, although Stan Gordon, again, this top-notch investigator, has talked off the record to some inside people. And, there are so many people, George, that haven't even been willing to go public on this case. So, we're aware of a lot more people than we're even allowed to talk about. So, but in terms of publicly coming forward, no, we have not. It's sort of strange to me that we haven't had anybody come out and say, I was on duty that night with the Army.
James Fox standing by, putting this national news conference together on Monday. James, what's your thought on Kecksburg?
Sorry, you blanked out there for a second. What was the last one?
What's your thought on Kecksburg?
Well, I'm very excited about what Leslie's going to uncover with this whole event. I think, you know, it's somewhat reminiscent of the craft that, even though the shape is different, Pennison described a craft, which we'll hear about later on the show, with hieroglyphics on it, no visible means of propulsion, no ports, doors, windows, that sort of thing. So I think it's a fascinating case, and I'm excited to hear, you know, what NASA's response is going to be.
Wow, you put together some heavy hitters on this situation here, James.
Well, Leslie Kane has done a lot of that work. She's been amazing.
Leslie, you're not going to stop from just this case, are you?
You mean the Kecksburg case?
Kecksburg, no, you're going to keep
going. I mean, I've been doing a lot of other things over the years besides Kecksburg, too, and investigating lots of other stories and so on. So, you know, I'm wide open, and this working on this press conference event has been a major focus of mine for many months now. So, I see this as an open-ended situation, and there's a lot of things I'm interested in.
Had you worked with John Podesta at all? Who was part of Clinton's group?
Who was Clinton's former chief of staff, has been a major supporter. I've been very fortunate to have his support in the whole Kecksburg effort, really from the very beginning, which was in 2002. And he's come out to numerous press conferences that we held and spoke publicly about this effort. So it's really been great because he's an incredible guy. He's brilliant, and he draws attention to the case. So that's been another really, he's been an incredible person, a part of our team as well. I've been very fortunate to have these people stand behind me on this.
Can I ask a quick question, Leslie?
Absolutely. Go ahead, James.
Who was it, Leslie, that actually, the judge that, was it a settlement with NASA that, was it the judge that made the decision?
Yeah, I mean, the judge asked us in great frustration, because I went to a hearing in March on this NASA case with my attorney. The judge was really frustrated with NASA. And he was, like, scolding them like they were bad kids. It was just amazing to hear them. And he said to the court, he said to our attorney in there, you guys have got to settle this thing because we've been going back and forth with this judge for so long. He was just exasperated. He said, I don't know how to figure out what to do here. I don't know how to make NASA cooperate. He just threw up his hand and said, what should we do? So he suggested that we try to work out a settlement between us that's acceptable to both of us. And that's what happened. But the settlement was really totally in our favor.
Yeah, they didn't want to settle. They didn't want to settle, did they?
Well, they wanted to settle because they wanted to get the thing over with. You know, everybody kind of wanted it to end, you know, and so we could move on. But they, you know, they had to give up a lot. I mean, they didn't get anything out of the settlement. They even had to pay our legal fees. So it was a settlement, but it was really a settlement in our favor.
Who will monitor what they do? A court supervisor?
The federal court is going to monitor it, which is another amazing thing. They have to file a written report with the court, I think every 30 days, every month and a half, something like that, you know, letting the court know that they're complying.
You don't think they would shred anything, do you, Leslie?
I don't think so, no. I really don't. I mean, I don't think personally that the people working in the FOIA offices, the people that actually pull the documents, have any problem with helping us out. I mean, it's, you know, the person I'm going to be working with at NASA is probably going to find this thing interesting. So, you know, I just think that there's just been a lot of, you know, they're overworked. They just don't get things done. They're negligent and irresponsible. But I don't think there's anything going on at the level of shredding things.
All right, Leslie, good luck at the news conference on Monday, okay?
Okay, thanks a lot, George.
That's investigative journalist Leslie Kane. Good night to you. In a moment, an initially trained military aircraft maintenance officer joins us with an incredible story on Coast to Coast AM. Charles Hult was initially trained by the military as an aircraft maintenance officer and installation commander. Charles was assigned to the Royal Air Force Bentwaters, England, as deputy base commander, later the base commander. He would go on to write the infamous Hult memo detailing the Rendlesham Forest RAF Bentwaters Woodbridge UFO incidents. Charles has a bachelor's degree in economics and chemistry and an MBA in business management, and here he is. Charles, how are you?
Good morning. I'm doing fine. How are you?
Good. I'm doing wonderful. Thank you. But now tell me about the case. How far back does this one go?
1980, December 1980.
Okay. Now, you were the base commander, and tell me your involvement in this incredible story.
Actually, when the story unfolded, I was the deputy base commander. I later became
okay.
base commander.
Right, right.
I had been assigned there that previous summer. That was the summer of 1980. At Christmas time, we were having the annual, what we called the combat support group. It was all the officers from the assigned to the base. And I had a Christmas party. It was a family cover dish dinner. Two nights prior to that.
No, go ahead.
Our young security police officer who was on duty had a very unusual experience. RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge were a twin base complex separated by approximately 3 miles of what we would call National Forest. It's called the Queen's Forest or the King's Forest, I guess, for the word king. On the night of, or the morning of the 26th of December, when the security police were checking the back gate between the two bases, they noticed something strange in the forest. It appeared to be an aircraft had downed. They saw flashing lights and whatnot in the forest through the trees as they checked the gate. So they called the law enforcement desk sergeant and asked if he knew of anything. He called the control tower, and they said, no, there's nothing flying. There's nothing in the area. We've had nothing reported. And they called Heathrow Airport and said, no, there's no indication of anything in the area or anything down, although they did pick up some strange blips on their scope.
Okay.
So three of the security policemen went off the base to investigate, and so started a very strange tale. They were having troubles with their radios, and this was quite unusual because the land there was very flat. It was along the coast, and the radios are line of sight, and they work very well normally. They were breaking up, so the three young air policemen started off the base, and because they were having problems with the radios, they left one halfway out into the forest, so to speak, and two of them proceeded on. And according to them, they came upon a strange craft, triangular in size, sitting on three legs. They actually approached the craft, and one of them noticed strange markings. He took numerous photographs, and at some point, the object sort of levitated and was gone in a flash.
So it didn't crash, Charles. It merely landed.
It didn't crash. No, it appeared because I saw the indentations of where the three legs extended. And it didn't appear to have crashed. It did come down through a very thick, dense pine forest. So there were evidence we discovered later of broken branches on the trees.
Was there anything unusual about that region that might have had, if it was a craft from outer space, land there?
That's a very historic area. First of all, that was the home of British witchcraft, that area, not very far away, Bodsey. During the Second World War, the experimental radar stations were very close by. There's a nuclear power plant. We were there. There's all sorts of interesting things that could have attracted something to that area.
So I'm interested in, first of all, the three that went out there in the photographs. And then tell us, Charles, about the landing marks that you witnessed.
What I witnessed when I went out was three indentations approximately an inch and a half, maybe an inch and three-quarter deep, equal distance apart, made a perfect triangle. The indentations were about 10 or 12 inches in diameter. I'd taken along a technician with a Geiger counter only to dispel, because I really didn't believe anything happened there, and I was firmly convinced up until later events that there was an explanation for what had been seen in the forest. But there was definitely much higher radiation than background radiation in the area, and especially in the center of the triangle formed by the three indentations. When the Geiger counter, which was an APN 27, was put against the trees, the inside of the trees, the side toward the landing site, supposedly, versus the outside, was much hotter. The readings were not high enough to be dangerous, but they were definitely about 10 times normal background radiation.
Was there any scorch marks in the middle of this triangular-shaped landing pad?
No, I didn't notice any scorch marks, but I did notice that the area there had been sort of scruffed up, a lot of pine needles on the floor of the forest, and it looked like something had done something to them.
How soon did you go out there after it apparently took off?
Two nights later. Because when I first heard of the incident, we kind of smiled and laughed about it, but there's a reasonable explanation to this, and really didn't give it a whole lot of thought, to be honest with you. But two nights later, when we were having the Christmas party, and the police came in right before dessert, of all things, and said, it's back. And, of course, the base commander and I were quite, what? What's? And he went on to say, you know, that UFO or whatever it is back in the forest out there. Well, my boss had to make the presentations to recognize people for various things throughout the year. So it was decided that I would go home and change clothes, because I was well-dressed, and go out in the forest and put this whole thing to rest. And that was what my intent was. And that's why I took a technician with a Geiger counter. I took my little portable tape recorder and had somebody with a camera.
As you were going out there, Charles, could you see the light?
I did not see anything until we got near the site because the lay of the land.
All right, you get onto the sightseeing. What do you see?
Well, the police show me these three indentations, and we're marking them, and I was making verbal notes into my tape recorder, and the technician with the APN-27, the Geiger counter, was getting readings, and we were putting them all on the tape recorder, and all of a sudden, the police lieutenant who had brought me out there said, "Look over there," and there, through the forest, you could see a glowing object. Best way I can describe it is it looked like an eye. It was oval. My guess is it was 10, 12, maybe 15 inches in diameter, possibly a little larger. It had a black center, and it appeared to be like it was winking. And it was, the best way I can describe it, the equivalent of molten metal pouring off it, just dripping off it as though it was coming out of a crucible. The object moved horizontally through the trees. It came toward us at one point. It receded. Bobbed up and down a little bit as though it were trying to avoid any obstacles such as the trees. We watched it for probably a minute or two and decided to try and approach it. As we moved forward, it receded out into the farmer's field, which was on the far side of the forest. And silently, the best way I can describe it is exploded into five white objects, and they disappeared. Prior to it exploding, we noticed in the farmhouse across the field that the house appeared as though it were on fire. I suspect it was the reflection of the light off the windows, but it was sort of
good point. Yeah,
orangish red glow and flickering.
Prior
concern for the people in the house.
Oh, absolutely. Prior to it exploding or breaking itself up, did you see the landing pads that you had seen the indentations of earlier? Did you see the pads sticking out of the bottom of the craft
like that? I did not. I could not see a clearly defined craft.
You could not. Okay.
I could only see an object that appeared to be, like I say, a burning object, an oval-shaped object.
Was it that bright?
It was very bright. It was so bright that I couldn't see any appendages or anything on it.
And it just blasted into five little pieces and off they went.
Huh? It did it quietly. There was no noise at all. So I said, let's go out into the field and see if we can find any scorch marks or any evidence of whatever was dripping off it. So we're out in the field with flashlights looking in the ground trying to find things, and about all we can find is evidence that the cattle had been there. When suddenly somebody said, look up in the sky, look there. And up in the northern sky, there were three elliptical objects moving at very high speed and making sharp angular movements as though they were doing some sort of a grid search or something. We watched them for several minutes, and then we saw two objects to the south. One of those objects approached at very high speed. It was, my guess, is 2,000-3,000 feet in the air. It stopped overhead and sent down a beam. It was a very unusual beam in that it didn't radiate out. It was a steady beam, just like a laser beam. It came down 5 or 6, maybe 10 feet from our feet, and we stood there in awe. You know, is this something trying to communicate? Is it trying to warn us? Is it trying to
harm you? Yeah.
We were really concerned then. And as suddenly as the beam went on, it went off. We noticed the other object to the south in the sky was sending down beams into the weapon storage area and other portions of the base. And that was verified on the radios. I got on the radio and called the command post and had them call Eastern Radar, who had responsibility for the air defense of that area, and ask them if they had anything or could find anything on the scope. The answer was no. However, I later found out from one of the civilian technicians that they did pick up some things on the tapes, and the tapes disappeared.
The tapes disappeared.
They make tapes of the radar.
Unusual for them to disappear, though.
Pardon?
It's unusual for them to disappear, though, isn't it?
I would certainly think so.
Yeah.
Also, the film that was taken on the first night by Sergeant Peniston was turned into the photo lab, and it mysteriously disappeared. And the film that was from the night we were out there was all fogged. Now, that could have been because of the radiation, and it could have been a mistake in the darkroom.
In your opinion, Charles, what do you think you all saw that night?
We saw something under intelligent control. I didn't see any little green men. I didn't see a clear shape. In other words, I can't say I saw a spaceship or whatever. We saw something that there's no explanation for.
Could you say, could you guess that the control might have been us, either the British
no,
or the
I
United
don't think
States?
So. Even today, I don't think we have the technology to move something about that way. I've even considered the possibility of mass hypnosis and several other things, but nothing seems to fit, not even ball lightning.
Could it have been dimensional, from another dimension, another multiverse?
It certainly could have been. It was something beyond anything we know.
Were you able to get pictures later of the three landing marks?
No, I don't have any pictures, but I do have a plaster impression.
Uh-huh.
The day after the first three security policemen had been out in the forest, one of them went back, Jim Peniston went back, and made plaster casts of the three indentations, one of which I still have in my possession.
Is it strange for you to look at it?
It gives me a strange feeling, yes. I definitely know something was there. All right, keep in mind, the forest floor there is quite hard. It's a hard-packed, sandy soil.
Right.
It takes something, probably 1,000, 2,000 pounds to make an indentation like that, especially three of them.
Was there a black ops investigation afterwards?
I didn't know of any investigation at that time. When I turned my tape, my little tape recorder that I made over to my boss, and he took it to 3rd Air Force and played it for the staff there, they all scratched their heads, so to speak, and questioned him as to, was I reliable? And he said yes. And the staff didn't know what to do, so the general at that time said, well, it happened off the installation. It's a British issue. Let the British take care of this. So my boss came back, gave me the tape back, and said, write a report to the British. This is a bit unusual. Nobody really wanted to touch the issue, really, when you boil, comes right down to it.
I believe we might have played a little bit of that tape about a year ago on this program. Would that have been yours?
It could be.
It might have been.
What happened was I made a copy for somebody, and then they shared it with somebody, and next thing I knew,
it's all over the place.
For sale on the internet and for sale through some magazines.
Yeah, yeah.
Very unusual followers for UFOs, I've discovered.
It might have been you that we had played a little clip on, Charles. It's a remarkable story. I mean, absolutely remarkable. Do you think somewhere there are some confidential files that might give us the answers to what was out there that night and those nights?
I'm not sure it would give us an answer, but it would certainly give us an answer as to how things, the inner workings of some of the government agencies. Because I later found out that the three young airmen that were out there, three young airmen, one was a sergeant, and another wannabe, actually were taken in by certain agencies and very discreetly hypnotized and given sodium pentothal, or at least we think
what?
Sodium pentothal.
They were drugged and hypnotized?
That's what they say.
Do they have any recollection of what they might have said?
Well, all I can tell you is hearsay, but I know at least one of them's undergone regression hypnosis and can go back and recant some of the events that happened then. I didn't know of any of this at the time. It was all done extremely discreetly.
But how close?
Certainly had an agency on the base that had the capability to do those things if they wanted to.
How close, Charles, did they get to the craft on that first landing?
According to them, the one actually touched the craft. Took copious notes, which he has today, and took the photographs, which, of course, the film disappeared.
What did it feel like? Did he say?
I can only tell you what he described, that it had strange markings on it, pure metallic.
We're going to be talking to Peniston a little bit later on in the program tonight.
I'll give you much greater detail as to what happened the first night.
And when you went back and made your initial report beyond the tape that they took and gave back, I mean, did they look at you like, we think Officer Hott is flipping out on us?
Well, it's very strange the way people treat you whenever you come forward. I wished after I'd gotten out there, I wish I hadn't gotten involved in this. I said, how am I ever going to explain this? Nobody will ever believe this. Fortunately, there were enough people involved, and I had the tape, and I had people who were on the radio nets and all that, probably 200 or 300 people were involved in one way or another from a distance, and the 4 or 5 that were with me and some in the background. So there were enough credible people around that something happened, and people recognized that. But it kind of became a joke. I didn't know what to do as far as the report because our liaison officer from the RAF was on holiday in Wales at the time. So I had to wait for him to come back from vacation. And I went to him, and he was really upset. So he called somebody, one of his superiors in the Ministry of Defense, and he said, we'll make a report. So I typed up that infamous memo called Unexplained Lights, gave it to him, and he sent it off. And we waited, and he made inquiries, and nothing happened. As far as we knew, nothing happened. We found out a lot of things did happen in the background, but they were done very, very discreetly.
And discretion to me means that they need to keep it a secret. James Fox, of course, putting on this news conference. Charles, you know him well. James, another great case, isn't it?
It's an amazing case, you know, and I actually interviewed the General Gordon Williams just fairly recently. Colonel Holt, did you see that sequence with the interview with General Gordon Williams?
Yes.
You know, it was interesting to me that he was not at all pleased with the release of that document. But how could a document of that nature have been released? Wasn't he the head of the base?
Let me explain something. I wasn't pleased either. It was approximately 2 years later, I got a call from the then 3rd Air Force Commander, Pete Bent, who was a friend of mine. And he said, we've found a copy of this memo over here. And he described, and I said, how did you get that? Well, obviously what happened is Squadron Leader Moreland, the RAF liaison officer at our base, had sent a copy to his superior 3rd Air Force, who shared it with some Americans there, I don't know who, and it kind of floated around there for a while. And somebody talked to somebody, and a writer in the United States found out about it and came in under the Freedom of Information Act and asked for the release of it. He knew specifically what he was asking for. So Pete Bent called me and said, I'm going to have to release this document. My comment to him was, burn it. Get rid of it. He said, my life will never be the same, and neither will yours. He laughed and said, I have no choice.
He might have been right, and you were right. Charles, good luck at the news conference next week, okay?
Well, thank you.
All right, what an incredible story. More to come on Coast to Coast AM.